Dev is on trial for robbing a bank. Prosecutors subpoena his wife, Priya, who watched him stuff bundles of cash behind a loose panel in their garage that night. She is willing to testify. Dev's lawyer moves to keep her off the stand entirely because he is the defendant and she is his wife. Does that work? No. The spousal testimonial privilege belongs to her, not to him. She alone decides. But ask a different question. Can the prosecutor ask what Dev told her in the kitchen that night? That one is blocked by a completely different privilege. Same marriage, same trial, opposite answers. And that is this topic. The proof here is often perfectly reliable, and the law throws it out anyway. Here's the root. First, how privileges work at all, and the two ideas running through every one. Then the two spousal privileges, which the exam loves to blur. Then attorney-client, and work product, which is a different animal. Then the two patient privileges, where federal and state law split. And finally, the policy exclusions, rules 407 through 411. Start with a surprise. The federal rules mostly do not spell out the privileges. Rule 501 sends federal courts to common law principles as reason and experience have shaped them. And it adds a twist. In a civil case where state law supplies the rule of decision, a diversity case, that state's privilege law governs. The same conversation can be privileged in one courtroom and fair game in another. Every privilege shares one skeleton, a confidential communication in a protected relationship made for that relationship's purpose. Confidentiality means it was meant to stay private, so a stranger's presence usually destroys it, though an agent needed to make the consultation work does not. Then, waiver. The holder gives it up by voluntarily disclosing or by failing to object. But an inadvertent disclosure is not a waiver if the holder took reasonable steps to prevent it and promptly fixed the error. FRE 502B. Produce 50,000 pages under a screening protocol, let one memo slip, claw it back 2 days later, and the privilege holds. And now, the single most useful sentence in this topic. A privilege hides the communication, never the underlying fact. Opposing counsel may ask a witness what happened. They may not ask, "What did you tell your lawyer?" On to the spouses, where there are two privileges, not one. Testimonial immunity is about whether a spouse can be forced to take the stand at all. Marital communications is about keeping private things said between spouses secret. Testimonial immunity appears only in criminal cases, and it is broad. It covers everything the witness spouse knows, including events from before the marriage, because it shields her from being a witness at all. It belongs to her under the federal rule, needs a valid marriage at the time of trial, and dies at divorce. An ex-spouse is compellable like anybody else. Marital communications runs differently on every axis, civil and criminal both. It protects only confidential communications, words or acts meant to convey a message, not observations. Watching your husband come home bloodied is an observation, and she may describe it. The couple must be married when the words were said. Both spouses hold it, and it survives divorce and even death, which answers the question we opened with. Priya watching Dev hide the cash is an observation, and the testimonial privilege is hers, so he cannot stop her describing it. What he said in the kitchen is a confidential communication, and he is a holder. That he blocks. Both have the same escape hatch. Neither applies when the spouses are legal adversaries. One spouse suing the other, or charged with a crime against the other spouse or a child of either, and both fall away. Otherwise, an abuser could silence the household that needs to testify. Next, the oldest privilege in the common law. You cannot get good legal help unless you can tell your lawyer the whole ugly truth. Four elements. A communication. between privileged persons, made in confidence, for the purpose of obtaining or providing legal services. Every element is a trap, not the underlying facts and not a pre-existing document. Privileged persons includes a prospective client and agents needed for the consultation. And legal services means legal advice, not business advice. Email your lawyer asking about trademark risk and whether the slogan is catchy and only the first half is protected. Quick challenge. A businessman keeps a private diary describing a shady deal, written years before any trouble. Once he is sued, he mails it to his lawyer, hoping the lawyer's file will shield it. Privileged or not? Not. A pre-existing document does not become privileged by being handed to a lawyer, or anyone could hide incriminating papers by mailing them to an attorney. The privilege covers the communication, not the cargo. 3 points on scope. The client holds it, so only the client waives. For an individual, it survives death, and corporations are clients too. The federal approach protects a communication from any employee to company counsel, made at management's direction, about matters within their duties for legal advice to the company. The control group idea was rejected, so a warehouse worker qualifies. Then the exceptions. And the one tested constantly is crime fraud, which turns entirely on timing. Communications furthering a future or ongoing crime are not protected. Confessing a past one is. A client who admits embezzling $40,000 last year is sealed. The same client asking help to draft phony invoices for next quarter is not. Now, work product, which students constantly fold into the attorney-client privilege, it is a different animal, protecting materials prepared by or for a party in anticipation of litigation. An investigator's notes, witness interviews, strategy memos. Codified in FRCP 26B3, and it grew out of Hickman versus Taylor. Two differences decide questions. Work product is not limited to communications with a lawyer, so an investigator's file can qualify. And it does not require confidentiality. What it requires is that the material was prepared because of anticipated litigation. Documents made for ordinary business reasons, or that would have existed anyway, are not work product. And it comes in two tiers. Fact work product is discoverable on substantial need plus an inability to get the equivalent without undue hardship. Opinion work product, the lawyer's mental impressions and legal theories, is nearly absolute. So an insurer's accident report splits. The valve readings may be reachable. The pages about fault are not. Two patient privileges and the split is heavily tested. There is no physician-patient privilege at federal common law. None. It exists only where a state statute creates one. The patient holds it, and the classic limit is that it is waived when the patient puts their own physical condition at issue, which is exactly what a personal injury plaintiff does. Federal courts do recognize a psychotherapist-patient privilege adopted under Rule 501, because therapy depends on candor that only confidentiality makes possible. It covers psychiatrists, psychologists, and licensed clinical social workers, and the exception mirrors the other. A plaintiff suing for her own emotional distress has put her mental condition at issue and cannot seal the records that test the claim. Now the second family, rules 407 through 411. Not about relationships at all. They keep out relevant evidence to encourage behavior society wants, fixing hazards, settling disputes, helping the injured. And everyone follows the same pattern. Barred for one purpose, admissible for others. Rule 407, subsequent remedial measures. A later repair cannot prove negligence. a product or design defect, or the need for a warning. Two keys. Timing, because the measure must come after the injury sued upon. And purpose, because it still comes in to impeach or to show ownership, control, or feasibility, if genuinely disputed. So a store bolts non-slip treads onto a ramp the day after a customer falls. The plaintiff cannot say they added treads, so the ramp was dangerous. But let the manager testify the ramp was as safe as it could possibly be, and the treads come in to impeach him and show a safer design was feasible. He put feasibility in dispute. And under the federal rule, 407 reaches strict products liability, too. Quick challenge on timing. A press injures worker A in January. In March, the manufacturer redesigns the guard. In June, worker B is hurt by an older press of the same model and sues. Can worker B show his jury the March redesign? Yes. The redesign came before his injury, so as to him, it is not a subsequent measure at all. Timing is measured against the injury being sued upon, not against the world.
Rule 408, Compromise, offers to settle a disputed claim, and statements made during settlement talks cannot prove the claim's validity or amount, or impeach by a prior inconsistent statement. Two requirements: a genuine dispute about liability or amount, so a debtor who concedes everything and wants more time is not protected. And the statement must be part of negotiations. And the federal rule is broader than students expect. Even factual admissions made during negotiations are protected. We will pay $9,000 to make this go away, and frankly, our driver probably was going a bit fast. None of that comes in. It still opens for bias, negating undue delay, or proving an effort to obstruct a criminal investigation. Rule 409, Medical Expenses. Paying or offering to pay someone's medical bills after an injury cannot prove liability. The Good Samaritan Rule. But two sharp differences from 408, no dispute is required. And 409 protects only the offer or payment, never the statements that ride along. Rule 411, Insurance. Whether a person carried liability insurance cannot prove they acted negligently. Insurance says nothing about care, and juries award more when they think an insurer pays. But it comes in for bias, so the plaintiff may reveal that the key defense witness is the claims adjuster employed by the defendant's insurer. And one cousin? Rule 410, Pleas. Withdrawn guilty pleas, no contest pleas, and statements during plea negotiations with the prosecutor stay out. But a guilty plea that stands is admissible, and the talks must be with the prosecuting attorney. The same admission made to a police detective comes in. A word on authorities. This episode named exactly one case, Hickman versus Taylor, and only because work product is the one doctrine here carrying a name lawyers still use. Everything else runs on rule numbers and common law principles, which is how next-gen questions come at you. They give you a fact pattern and ask what stays out. If you keep only three things, keep these. Rule 501, which sends federal courts to the common law and diversity cases to state privilege law. The sentence that a privilege hides the communication and never the fact. And the shape of rules 407 through 411, where the answer is usually admissible, but only for bias, feasibility, ownership, or control, not fault. This topic is starred, so nothing is printed for you. Now the traps, straight from the examiner's favorites. 1. Do not blur the two spousal privileges. Testimonial immunity is criminal only, covers all testimony, needs a marriage at trial, and dies at divorce. Marital communications covers only confidential words said during the marriage and survives divorce. 2. A privilege hides the communication, never the facts. 3.
Pre-existing documents are not privileged just because they sit in a lawyer's file. 4. Business advice is not legal advice. 5. Crime fraud reaches only future or ongoing crimes, so a past confession stays sealed. 6. No federal physician-patient privilege, but there is a federal psychotherapist-patient privilege. 7. Attorney-client survives death. And on the policy side, Rule 408 needs a disputed claim. Rule 409 shields only the payment, so the admission riding along comes in, and that contrast is a favorite. A remedial measure must follow the injury sued upon. A guilty plea that stands is admissible. And always ask the decisive question, for what purpose is this evidence offered? Time for the quick check, and this one comes straight from the Bargo question bank. Moments after a two-car crash, before anyone has asserted a claim or disputed anything, one driver hurries over to the other, who is visibly injured. He blurts out, "I am so sorry. I completely ran the red light. Please let me pay your hospital bills." She is later treated and sues. At trial, she wants the jury to hear both halves of that sentence. What, if anything, comes in? Option 1. Both are excluded, because together they were a single humane gesture. Option 2. Both are admissible, because at that moment, no claim had been asserted or disputed. Option 3. The admission of running the light comes in, but the offer to pay medical bills is excluded. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 3. Rule 409 excludes an offer to pay medical expenses and needs no dispute at all, so the absence of a claim does not help her. There goes option 2. But 409 protects only the payment, never the statement riding along, "So I ran the red light" comes in. There goes option 1. Had this been a settlement over a disputed claim, Rule 408 would have covered the admission too. One sentence, two rules, opposite results. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone, each with every option explained like that. 5 things to take away. 1. A privilege hides the communication and never the underlying fact, and an inadvertent disclosure with reasonable precautions and a prompt clawback is not a waiver. 2. Testimonial immunity is criminal only and dies at divorce. Marital communications covers only words said during the marriage and outlives it. 3. Attorney-client needs confidentiality and legal advice and survives death. Work product needs anticipated litigation and no confidentiality and splits into fact and opinion tiers. 4. No federal physician privilege, a real federal psychotherapist privilege, and both give way when the patient puts that condition at issue. 5. Every policy exclusion bars one purpose and permits others, which is why Priya decides for herself whether to take that stand, and why what Dev said to her in the kitchen stays out either way. Next time, hearsay and non-hearsay. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice. And we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.